Tonight on Arena. A new play from The Fringe, confronting Ireland's class issues. Alan Corr looks at the new Led Zeppelin documentary and Martin Hayes on Masters of Tradition. If you'd like to text us at any point during the programme tonight, you can email arena@rte.ie, and we are on X at RTE Arena. We're starting tonight with a new play. It premieres at the Dublin Fringe Festival and wants to challenge the idea that Ireland doesn't have a class system and that we're a proudly classless society. Yeah, That's So Povo is full of charm and humour and a force of nature in the form of a drag queen, and it's written by Sophie O'Toole and Trudy Nolan, who join me now in studio. Welcome to Arena, both of you.
Thank you so
much. Thanks for having us.
Before we get onto the play, I want to talk to the two of you about how you met. It was hearing each other's accents on the first day of drama school. Like, Trudy, why was that so important?
Yeah, it was just like the fact that I remember we went in on the very first day and everyone, our teacher made us like sit down in a circle. It was called the drama circle. And it was like everyone was numbered, or not numbered, it was like alphabetical. Mm-hmm. And I was T, so I was the last one. And we had to go around and everyone talk about like their experience in drama, what brought them to drama college, what they were interested in, which was a great introduction. But it made me very quickly realise that I was not like a lot of people who were sitting in the circle with me. I started doing drama when I was about 16, and everyone was like, I have been acting since I was 8 years old, 9 years old. And I was like, oh my God. And I remember we were doing an exercise about a box, an invisible box, and what was in it, of course, because it's drama college. Mm-hmm. And the teacher asked Sophie, what's in your box? And she turned around and went, a cat. And I heard cat. And I went, okay, this is someone who's like me, who's in the room. And I think you heard my accent. And then we kind of slowly just started shifting over towards each other. Yeah. And we were like, where are you from? So it was that kind of thing of just feeling like there was someone else there with me that understood me a bit and kind of got my experience. And then the longer we went on, the more I think that companionship really mattered to us. And when we started seeing a bit of a divide, we were just both so grateful to have each other in that class, you know.
Why did you both want to become actors? Sophie, maybe I'll start with you.
Oh my God. So I was around 10 and I was watching telly one day and Death Becomes Her was on the TV. Have no idea why. And I saw Meryl Streep and I said, who is this woman? So I ran to my nanny. I actually live right next door to my nanny. And I was like, nanny, did you hear about this film? And, like, me thinking it's brand new. And she was like, yeah, Sophie, that's Meryl. Like, do you not know who Meryl is? And I started to look into Meryl Streep's career. And I basically wouldn't stop talking about this woman. I mean, and then when I got to secondary school, I was offered to go and audition for a scholarship to a drama school. And I went and I done the audition and I got into the drama school. And then as soon as that scholarship was over for the year, I got myself a little job and me and my family just started paying for these classes. Mm. And I've kind of been on this crazy train chasing down Meryl Streep ever since, to be honest with you.
It's brilliant that you accidentally picked the greatest living actress in the world. That helps. That's fantastic. Trudy, you?
For me, I was always a sporty kid. I was a like swim team kid. I did like Gaelic football. I was really into sports. So I never really thought like drama was a thing. And nobody did drama around me. There was like one fella in my whole year in school that did drama. And I remember just like not even being an option in my head. And it just seemed like something that was really high up and prestigious. And I was like, well, all my mates just play sports and we all just, this is what we just do. So I was always doing that. And then I was in school and there was this festival on in Talla, the ACT UP festival. And one of my friends said to me, do you want to do it with us? Because it's led by students. So I went in and I did it, but I kind of did it once and I was like, oh, that's grand, you know, like, and then I didn't really pursue drama after that. Mm. And then I did it the following year again. And I was like, a couple of people were saying to me, no, like you could do this and all. But I hadn't quite seen myself on the stage. So I was like, oh, do you know what? Like, I leave that to the side. And then there was another opportunity, which was Tenderful in the Civic in Talla. And they had like a writing section. So you could write your play and then you could act in it as well. Not act in that play, but act in another play. Mm. And when I did that, it was the first time I seen my own voice on stage. And we started to go see shows that were like €5 in or free in. And it was like really accessible. And I went, I remember the first show I seen was Howie the Rookie by Marco Rowe, and Stephen Jones was playing Howie, and he walked on stage, and the minute he walked on stage, I went, I know that fella. I didn't know Stephen Jones, but I knew the fella I was looking at on stage.
I'm conscious Tala has gotten a mention, so Cronin obviously needs to get a mention.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
As well, because for the sake of balance, obviously, I know your family are listening tonight
as well. Representation.
I'm going to play a clip from the play from That's So Povo. Let's have a listen to this.
Once upon a time, and a long, long time ago, before there was man, before there was woman, before there was sliced bread.
God, I'd love some Brennan's now.
There was us. The loud, the proud, the gob. The saints, the scholars.
The scangers.
We planted our roots all across Miss Ballyhale, Clea. But then...
The horror!
The gee bags tried to domesticate us. Erase us. But we are here. We'll always be here. And she's been here the whole time. All hail, Queen Povo.
Thanks that I get for putting you bitches on. Is it...
A new queen has entered the chat. Oh, yeah. I'm about to... I'm about to... Sorry, excuse me. here, don't you just hate when a bit of gentrification gets caught in your throat? Anyways, as the gentrified queenie was about to say, I'm about to flip this kip upside down, inside out, gear up, gear ra, ya maz, ya da.
Who are you riding to get that Range Rover?
I love it when C-Matt manages to get sneaked, even just a tiny little bit into a room. That happens all the time. That's from That's So Povo. Sophie O'Toole and Trudy Nolan, the writers, are with me. Explain, just in case anybody doesn't know, what the word povo means.
So, povo is a term that was used to describe a certain item. And we heard this a lot in our years in college, and it would often be used in reference to something that was part of a working class culture, you know. That Juice Couture tracksuit was so povo. And ultimately, it's a shortened down word for poverty. Mm-hmm. And me and Trudy were really confused when we heard this word first. We didn't really understand what was going on. But it was kind of a word that had been circulating and getting more and more popular amongst people, because it almost seemed like they couldn't say other words to describe us, so they made their own new word. And I mean, that's constantly happening.
And the excuse we always heard was, oh, well, we're not calling people povo. We're just calling things povo.
Yeah.
But them things are quite a key part of the working class community and our identity and stuff.
Why do you think we don't talk about classism more? It's almost like it's an acceptable form of prejudice.
Well, it's interesting that you said at the opening there about how people see Ireland as a classist society. So it's not even seen as an issue. You know, it's not even seen that it's a thing that is happening. And I don't know, it's really interesting, because I do find sometimes it's to do with we don't have the language, we don't have the research to back it. Because, I mean, Sophie wrote her thesis on working class theatre, and I did a chapter on my thesis about it, and we both really struggled to find resources about it. It's not well researched, and we don't quite have that vocabulary to express it. And I feel like, you know, when you are growing up in a working class area, everyone's like you. So you're not, you know, you're not really necessarily seeing the other side of it. It's more, well, everyone's like that. So then when you kind of expand out and you see other people's perspectives, it is quite a slap in the face.
It is.
I'm interested. Women frequently make themselves smaller to fit in one form or another. Would you say that working class women have an even tougher job?
100%. I mean, I think just women in general, we're told to be smaller because we take up too much room, and it's almost seen as unattractive. Where when working class women are too loud and we're too proud, it's almost seen as aggression, and it's this completely utter ball game against working class women. And I mean, just in terms of resources as well, it's very, very limited to us in kind of the grand scheme of things as well. But it is this thing of I don't really know. If you're too loud, you're seen as aggressive. If you're too passionate, you're seen as aggressive. And it's just leaning into the clutch of, you know, if you're working class, you're ultimately an angry woman. And it's like, no, I love who I am. I love where I'm
it's
from.
It's like, if you're not ashamed of where you're from, you're aggressive. You're the problem.
And these are all strands that are unpicked in the play. I'm conscious we haven't actually talked about the play itself. Have you got like a potted version of what happens in the play?
Yeah.
That's So Povo is basically a play about two college students who are rehearsing a Sean O'Casey scene, and they kind of butt heads a little bit because they both have very different takes on their identity as working class women. And through this button of heads, they summon this larger than life Queen Povo character who comes in, and she's kind of a fairy godmother. Yeah. And she helps the girls navigate their experience and helps them come to terms of like, what is O'Casey, why, how does this represent us, and how are we going to present this?
I'm always interested in the idea of working class characters being represented on stage and on screen in particular, because frequently people only ever think of love, hate. They think of things like kin. They think of... Talk to me a little bit about positive representations of working class characters, maybe on TV or on stage. It's going to take a while, isn't it?
I think ultimately, to be honest, the best working class characters you'll ever see on any platform are the ones that are written by working class people, because it comes from a place of honesty and truth. Like, if you look at Sean O'Casey's work specifically, you know, there's resources and sources to say that he wrote about the people around them. You know, a lot of the women characters that he wrote about were his mom and his family members. And that's like a lot of us. We constantly want to emulate this community because it is spectacular what we have. Like, it is quite beautiful what we share with one another. And it's never spoken about amongst one another. It's a natural thing to gravitate towards each other, to be there for each other. And so when working class artists are given the platform in TV, in every art form, we write about ourselves and the people we love because it is spectacular to witness.
I just really quickly like to give one particular piece that actually drew me and Sophie together was Veronica Dias's piece, and it's called A Class, Life and Art. And it was kind of actually like a stage reading of an essay that she'd written, and it's all about how she doesn't want to work about class, doesn't want to talk about class, but she kind of keeps having to talk about it. And when we were doing our showcase for college, it was a piece that we ended our piece with, our whole showcase with, and it really drew us together because it talks about that experience of finding someone in college who has the same accent as you. And
yeah,
I mean, yeah, and we chose to do a lot of working class representation in our showcase. So there definitely is positive out there. It's just about elevating these people.
Yeah, spotlighting.
I'm conscious I have yet to mention that you're both only 22, which is terrifying. Absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
What do you want to do now that you've both found your voices and they're both your voices?
Well, we have a theatre company, which we started together. It was kind of always our dream. And then we were applying for Fringe, and a good pal of ours, Jennifer Webster, was like, so you're applying as a company? And we were like, we are now. Yeah. So we did it in the Square car park in my little red Micra at the time. We made an Instagram. And so at the moment, what we're really interested in is making work that represents our community, but also just making work that represents the bigger picture of like a lot of different things within Dublin. We're exploring other pieces at the moment. And we're really focused on that So Povo, obviously, with the Fringe coming
100%.
Up. 100%.
Our company is called The Girlos.
The Girlos.
Because we are girlos.
I was going to mention it. It's been so brilliant talking to both of you, Sophie O'Toole and Trudy Nolan. That's So Povo is presented by The Girlos Theatre, and it's in Bewley's Cafe as part of the Dublin Fringe Festival. There are performances from the 17th to the 20th of September at 1 p.m. and 6 p.m. And you'll find more, as usual, fringefest.com. Now on Arena, it is time for some Led Zeppelin. And that's the unmistakable sound of Good Times, Bad Times by Led Zeppelin, from Led Zeppelin 1, from their very first album. As one of the greatest bands of all time, they sold 200 million albums and set the template for rock bands for decades to come. There's a new documentary, it's called Becoming Led Zeppelin, and it's the story of their early years. Alan Corr from RTE Entertainment joins me in studio to tell me about the documentary. Alan, I presume this is mostly for Arena's younger listeners. Can you give us an idea of just how big Led Zeppelin were?
Well, I'm going to have to be fairly grandiose here, Rick, because, well, it's Led Zeppelin. I mean, half a century ago, they bestrode the earth like a rock colossus and really set the scene and the pace from 69 to the mid-70s. They featured the powerhouse vocals of Robert Plant, Jimmy Page's magical orchestral guitar, John Bonham's thunderous drums, and those beautiful, elegant bass and keyboard parts from John Paul Jones, which were really like the filigree to the whole sonic tapestry. I told you I was going to be grandiose because it is Led Zeppelin. So between 69 and 1982, they released 9 albums, and they mixed up blues, psychedelia, and later on reggae and world music. And I suppose they helped define the whole album era, a time when it wasn't about singles, it was about whole sides of albums being played on FM radio. This was in an age, Rick, when bands were known as groups. You probably remember that. And we know the songs Stairway to Heaven, Whole Lot of Love, Kashmir. And this is, of course, holding an era of like soppy singer-songwriters, you know. So they really did stand out. And I don't think anybody, even now at this 50-year remove, can deny their Promethean power and their sheer musicianship. I mean, they were majestic, they were mysterious, and they were even a little scary, I thought.
Not in this documentary, which is what makes the documentary so interesting, because there are interviews with the three surviving members of the band and some very nice audio of the late John Bonham in it as well. The documentary, it's called Becoming Led Zeppelin. It's been a long time coming, but it's far from the first film about them.
Yes, I mean, this is the first official film authorised by the band. There's been movies before. There was 1976, fairly cringeworthy, The Song Remains the Same, which was a concert movie. There was 2012 Celebration Day, which was a very good concert film of the band's reunion to celebrate the life of Atlantic Records founder Emmett Artigan. But as I say, you know, a good, you know, generation after their breakup, they have authorised this. And they've always been very protective of their legacy. I mean, you need only look at the fact that they didn't want anyone to see their Live Aid performance in 1985 because it was enough to snuff. But the guys who directed this movie are Bernard McMahon, who is an Irish-British screenwriter and producer and director, and he wrote this and produced it with Alison McGurthy. Now, they are behind a series that went out on American TV a few years ago called American Epic, which looked at the roots and origins of American music through the years. And that would have appealed to someone like Page and Plant and indeed the whole band. So this is authorised. It's fully official. We've got the interviews with Plant, Page and John Paul Jones, who are all, you know, Plant is 76
now. All separately,
now,
we should point out.
All separately, exactly. So it's not like, for example, the Beatles anthology, where we saw the three remaining members of the Beatles in a room together, sometimes bickering with each other. These interviews are conducted separately. You have those great archive radio interviews with John Bonham, who died, unfortunately, at age 32 in 1980. So this is very enjoyable stuff.
Yeah, I hadn't twigged, I'm going to readily admit, that the title Becoming Led Zeppelin means it is about the early years. We were 5 minutes from the end and we were only on Led Zeppelin 2. And at that point I thought, aha, this might only be dealing with the earlier years.
Very much so. As you say, the clue is in the title, Becoming Led Zeppelin. It starts at the very start with Good Times, Bad Times, first song, first side of the first album in 69. And it really goes into their backgrounds, born into comfortable middle class backgrounds, their development, how they formed, how they went from the New Yardbirds to Led Zepp. So we're not going to get any of the madness. Anything like kind of like John Bonham riding kind of motorcycles through Tokyo hotel
really
rooms.
There really isn't that. It's almost the more interesting for that, because earlier on they do talk about influences and about how Lonnie Donegan and skiffle music was a huge influence on them, and James Brown. And in John Paul Jones' case, his parents were music hall entertainers.
Yes, fascinating. I mean, I didn't know that. Basically, they were kind of old music hall entertainers who would travel up and down the length and breadth of England, and he would go with them.
Yeah.
So I think she was a singer. He played piano and organ, and John Paul himself went on to play organ in his local church, which gives the lie to the decadent rock gods they became. Meanwhile, Robert Plant's parents wanted him to become a chartered accountant, which is a hoot. John Bonham's dad ran a building contractor, so John would work for his dad occasionally while also working for local bands. So they all came from very comfortable middle-class backgrounds, post-war Britain, Birmingham and London, and their parents were all very encouraging of them to get into music.
I want to take a first clip from the documentary, and Jimmy Page talks quite a lot in this doc, and early on he talks about becoming a session musician well before he gets into bands. He seems to think that that's where the money is to be made, and that some of his mates are in bands, but that's not really for him. This is Jimmy Page and John Paul Jones recalling their days as session musicians in Abbey Road. This is Gold Dust.
Here comes Jimmy Page with his electric guitar. That's my Les Paul, my Black Beauty. And this guitar was the guitar that I play most of my sessions on. There we are, going in there to see what I'm going to be faced with on that music stand.
Sessions were a lot of fun in those days, actually. When I started, I ended up playing a lot of sessions together with Jimmy.
Goldfinger!
The Goldfinger session was at Abbey Road. Jimmy and I were in the rhythm section. There was a full orchestra and Shirley Bassey.
A spider's touch.
The whole energy, just to be in there. I mean, you know, for me, I'm still a kid, really. And it's like, wow, it's Shirley Bassey.
While you were playing, you could see her, and she did the whole thing. God, it was wonderful to watch.
But don't go in.
Half of Led Zeppelin plays on Shirley Bassey's Goldfinger. Talk to me about when they finally formed Led Zeppelin, because it kind of starts to move for them fairly quickly.
Extraordinary. I mean, contrary to their name, which was originally going to be Lead Balloon, of course, it was preordained when you think about it, Rick. I mean, by the time they got together, as first the New Yardbirds and then Led Zeppelin, they had a huge wealth of experience. Jimmy Page and John Paul Jones were playing session musician stuff. John Bonham was playing a lot of bands. Plant already had been in bands like Band of Joy and Hobbs Tweedle, the little-known Hobbs Tweedle. So when they finally drew together, it took off a huge speed, alarming speed. I mean, they recorded their first album within a year of forming, before they even had a record deal, and they just took off like a bat out of hell. Extraordinary success very quickly.
I'm going to take just very briefly a clip here as well from the documentary. It's Jimmy Page, and he's telling the story about how he couldn't get the late Terry Reid, who passed away last week at the age of 75, as his main vocalist. But then this other guy, Robert Plant, gets suggested.
The next thing that I hear is that, oh, unfortunately, Terry Reid signed a solo deal with Mickey Mose. And I thought, oh, yeah. I thought, wow, this is super ruthless. But nevertheless, Terry Reid suggested a singer from the Midlands in a band called Hobbs Tweedle. And I thought, this is an unusual name. This is a bit odd.
He and Peter Grant came up to have a look at me. He asked me if I knew where he could find Robert Plant. And I said, yeah, right here.
He was doing some wonderful improvised vocals, and I thought they were marvellous. So I invited him around my house.
I still had nowhere to live, sadly. So I took my suitcase, got a train to Pangbourne, and knocked on another door.
Yeah, we had a really good connection. And I think, you know, we sort of looking through my records, I got that one, and, you know. And I played him a Joan Baez version of Babe, I'm Gonna Leave You, and said, well, if you can sing that top line there, I've got an arrangement that goes with it. And it just really, really dovetailed together. It was beautiful. He was so... He just sang beautifully.
Baby, 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 I'm gonna leave you.
This is Wednesday Night's Arena here on RTE Radio 1, and I'm talking to Alan Corr of RTE Entertainment about Becoming Led Zeppelin, the brand new documentary about the band. We kind of sort of skipped over Terry Reid, and I actually think he deserves a little bit more time in terms of his place in all of this.
Absolutely. Terry Reid only passed away last week, unfortunately. Of course, he was known as Super Lungs. He was one of the great session singers of that particular era, when kind of Led Zeppelin and the Yardbirds were coming up. And it's interesting when you look at the dynamic of how the band formed, because Jimmy Page, of course, was in the Yardbirds when they imploded. He already had his own plan. He wanted to form a band that wasn't about singles, it was about albums that he played in FM radio. So his manager, the Yardbirds manager at the time, Peter Grant, the famous Peter Grant, the man who invented the whole idea of the very imposing rock manager that has kind of gone on to influence other famous rock managers, including some Irish ones I could mention. So initially Page approached Terry Reid But he wasn't interested. But Plant was, and he kind of hooked up for the whole thing. And then Plant had to speak to John Bonham's wife, because John Bonham's wife, Pat, didn't really approve of Robert Plant. He would say to John Bonham, and this is John Bonham, the future Hellraiser, "I want you to stay away from that Planty." So Robert Plant spoke to Bonham's wife, Pat, and also Bonham's mum, to say his bona fides were okay, and it was okay for John and him to be in a band together.
Can John come out and play?
John can come out and play, exactly. Can I have my bass guitar back, please? So it's kind of cute when you think about the huge colossus, this corporation the band went on to become, the fact that kind of the lead singer had to ask the permission of the drummer's mum to form a band. It kind of gives it that very English charm, which kind of lends itself to the whole kind of history of the band. And it's also worth remembering that even before they'd released that first album, everybody in this film, Plant, Page and John Paul Jones, all say the same thing. They all say as soon as they heard John Bonham play, they knew they had something special.
Yeah.
And that says it all.
And I want to take a clip here, and it's from the earliest days of the band. This is their first session that they do together. They rent out a rehearsal room, and it's Page, Plant and Jones recalling the first time they played together. There is part of that recording of John Bonham talking about that day in here as well.
I said, the first number that I want to do is Train Kept a Rolling.
Train Kept a Rolling. She said, do you know it? I went, nope. He said, well, it's a 12 bar and it starts round, it's got this riff. Okay, count it in. And that was it. And the room just exploded.
We just kept playing it and doing like solo breaks and all the rest of it, and Robert's improvising.
I'd never heard anything like it. You know, I was expecting some cool soul singer, and there's this screaming maniac with this fantastic voice and fantastic range, you know. I was like, what are you doing up there? You hurt yourself, man.
It was devastating, because it seemed like that had been what I'd been waiting for.
Well, I was pretty shy. You know, the best thing to do when you're in a situation like that is not to say much and just to sort of soldier along and suss it all out sort of thing.
Well, being a bass player, and he was probably thinking the same thing, you know, because rhythm sections are very sensitive creatures, really. I just needed to know that we could work together.
The first time we played together, you know, you could tell it was going to be a good group, you know, not being sort of flash about it. But I am.
Marvellous.
When it finally came to a halt, I'm absolutely convinced that everyone knew that that was a life-changing experience.
That lovely moment where he says about Plant's vocals, what are you doing up there? You'll hurt yourself, man. Talk to me about the first album. It's one of the most interesting parts of the documentary, about how the album came together and then how they went and sought the record deal afterwards.
So they would have got together in that basement in Gerrard Street in London in 68. Then they would have rejoined to Bonham's house, which was a beautiful place down by the Thames outside London. You call the Thames or Mississippi, I suppose. And, you know, this album, this first album came together very quickly. It contains classics like Dazed and Confused, Communication, Breakdown and Good Times, Bad Times. And Plant, as you say, what are you doing? Get up and go doing all the way up there, you'll get a nosebleed. I mean, he really did scream down the halls of Valhalla, but they recorded it before they had a record deal. Page went over to New York with Peter Grant and played the masters to Jerry Wexler, Atlantic Records. And they signed this record deal, which at the time I think was worth about £1.5 million, which at that time in 69 or thereabouts was one of the biggest record deals of all time. So actually the album came out in January 69, so late 68. £1.5 million was a huge record deal back then. When you think about what bands sign for now, it's kind of interesting. And they had this extraordinary autonomy, complete control, as The Clash might later say. There was no singles. They didn't want any singles. And the only time they approved of a single was a re-release of Whole Lotta Love sometime in the 90s. The artwork would be there. Sometimes the name of the band wouldn't appear on the album cover. There'd be very little pictures of the band. So it was an extraordinary kind of landmark in heavy rock. And it was released in January 69 into this climate of civil rights. The Vietnam War was still raging. Social upheaval was happening. And it really captured that kind of apocalyptic dread of the era, because this was the start of what was going to be a very dark decade, the 1970s.
Let's have a listen to this. It is the band talking about that creative freedom and actually quite briefly talking about changing the name to Led Zeppelin as well.
Jimmy had fixed it so that Atlantic had no say in what we did whatsoever. They went there saying, look, you want this band and we're going to give you the music. But Peter Gott wouldn't let any record executives anywhere near the studio or the band. And they were terrified of it, which is brilliant, to have that freedom and was unheard of.
Rather than keep the Yardbirds name, the group became strong enough for me to start fresh, and it was a decision that we changed the name.
Keith Moon had suggested the name Led Zeppelin, and I thought that would be a great name to use.
And I thought, yeah, it's a terrible name. Nobody's going to remember that. But I couldn't come up with a better one, so Led Zeppelin we were.
And that's Jimmy Page talking about the initial record deal, and then all four of them talking about the Led Zeppelin name. I want to talk about the documentary itself. I mean, all in all, it's fairly traditional.
It is indeed. I mean, in recent years, we've had Asif Kapadia's superb documentary with Amy Winehouse, which is entitled Amy, and also Moon Age Daydream, which is Brett Morgan's brilliant experimental doc on Bowie. This is very different from that. This is a very traditional meat and two veg rock doc, and it deploys all the usual hackneyed visual language of the classic kind of rock and roll documentary. And you know something, Rick? Maybe that's as it should be, because these guys are a very traditional band, and it kind of captures that kind of that era, I suppose. There's no complications here in terms of the kind of the way that the film looks, but there's far too many on the road montages, shots of, you know, date itineraries, concert photos, and more than once we'll see a jet plane taking off into the sunset. So it, but at the same time, it kind of captures that kind of dazed hippie kind of, you know, milieu of the era. But you know, there's lots of endless visual noodling, lots of psychedelic extended montages of trippy live footage. So it's very traditional. And you know something, it works because of that, I think.
There is a lot of live performance footage kind of in the second half of it as well. So maybe if you're not a Led Zeppelin fan, that might be the point at which you start to wonder about the 7 minute song you've just been watching.
Well, I think that, you know, as a Led Zeppelin fan who knows a fair amount about them, I mean, the live footage is the selling point here, I think. You know, mm-hmm. That and the interviews with the archive interviews with John Bonham. There's a fantastic piece of footage from, I think, 1970 in black and white, where they're playing in front of an audience of mothers and children. I mean, there's middle aged women there with children on their laps, some babies there. There's kind of older kids with their fingers in their ears.
Somewhere in Scandinavian TV somewhere?
No, no, that was their first ever show when there were still the new Yardbirds back in 68. This is 1970 or thereabouts. And it looks like they're playing in front of school kids and housewives. And there's nothing wrong with that, obviously. But it's just really strange when you think about the huge enormous domes they would go on to play in America later in the 70s.
And because this is an official documentary, you're not going to get warts and all here.
No, absolutely not. And again, it's because of the band, the remaining members of the band, they're very protective of their legacy. This is the first official doc, you know, a long time after they broke up. But it's worth remembering as well that this is about the beginnings of Led Zeppelin. It's only about the first two albums. It's not about the decadence of the mid 70s. And, you know, it's interesting to note that even for those first two albums, most of them, I think all of them, were married men with kids at the time. And as Robert Plant has said in the past, like, a lot of those kind of places they played in the Midwest of America, they all closed at 10:30 at night. There was nowhere really to party. So the decadence and the madness came later, I think. It's not that they're coy about it. It's just that it's not mentioned at all in this documentary.
Is there any suggestion of a second half of it because of where it finishes? Or is there an element of this is the story we want to tell, because once we start telling the story beyond this, it gets very messy?
I have this idea, and correct me if I'm wrong, there is a series on Sky documentaries called Becoming The Clash, Becoming Steely Dan, Becoming whatever it might be. So I think that might be part of this. Do we really want another part of this? I'd like to see it. I mean, there's another two parts, if that's the case. And maybe they did shoot more. I don't know. But this is the origin story of Led Zepp.
Okay. Is it something you'd recommend?
I would. It ends rather abruptly, but I think, you know, they come across as total gents. They deserve this fond-eyed memorial. And despite the friction between the three of them, there's a whole lot of love here, Rick. I enjoyed it.
And a nice pun at the end. Good man. Thank you to Alan Corr for joining us tonight to tell us about the new documentary, Becoming Led Zeppelin. You can watch it on Sky Documentaries. And you're listening to Wednesday Night's Arena. Kate Ellis on cello and Cuivín O'Reilly on fiddle and viola are just two of the musicians appearing at this year's Masters of Tradition in Bantry. Opening next Wednesday, the festival runs for 5 days with emerging and established artists coming together in a series of gigs and talks. Martin Hayes founded the annual event more than 20 years ago. I'm delighted he joins me on the line now. Good evening, Martin. Welcome to Arena.
Oh, thanks very much. Delighted to be on.
The festival tagline is a celebration of Ireland's finest traditional music. So maybe to start, we'll hear Kate Ellis and Martin Hayes now as part of the Common Ground Ensemble on The Longford Tinker. The Longford Tinker. Martin, listeners might know that it was yourself and the Common Ground Ensemble recorded that. The album was Peggy's Dream in 2023. Can you tell us about the tune itself?
Well, it's a pretty common traditional tune. It's not a very unusual one, but it's kind of really like hearing the riff that the Kate plays there. It was kind of a question of finding a tune to put into that. So I had that. This reel was kind of in my head for some reason, but I had to modify it a little bit so that it kind of lined up with the rhythmic patterns of the cello and stuff. But then towards the end of the set, of course, we release it back to its traditional form. But yeah, so it's a standard of the tradition, I suppose, you know, that tune.
You play it a lot of festivals nationally and internationally. You've done so for a long time, but Masters of Tradition, it's obviously one that's very special to you.
Oh, yes, it is. No, I mean, it started in, we started it in 2003. And so, you know, I get to be a little self-indulgent, I suppose, in bringing lots of musicians that I enjoy listening to. And I get to sit there just like everybody else and enjoy those concerts too. But yes, it's been a privilege all the years, really, to hear so much great music.
What are the joys of a curation process like that for yourself? How does that work?
Well, you know, there's a bit of serendipity involved, of course, like who you meet, who you hear, what you hear. And then, you know, it's a bit like putting a concert together or a show, you know, putting an evening of music. You know, you're kind of like imagining like the shape of a week. You're imagining the shape of a day of music and what that would be like. And then just, you know, juxtapositioning these different musicians next to each other and whatnot can create a very interesting effect. And after a few days, you're kind of like a little bit punch drunk in a very good way, I would say, you know.
Is it sometimes the sort of effect that you might not necessarily know how things are going to work out until it's actually happened?
Well, you never do. I never really know what's going to go on. And almost every time I'm surprised by some artist, like, just surprise me and catch me off guard. You know, there can be exceptional performances, even, you know, that, you know, you might not have anticipated. So I always tell people to buy tickets to everything, you know. I don't know what's going to be the special moment. It's hard to tell, you know.
That is a sensible move on the part of any curator. Martin, yeah. Who is in this year's lineup? Who have you got?
Well, there's a whole lot of people, like, including Kate Ellis and Brian Donlan there, who were in that part of that opening track. But then there's two wonderful young fiddle players, Maria Ryan and Lucia McPartland, that are going to be doing interesting things. A Shano singer, Nadine Quirin, Brian Conway from America with Brendan Dolan. They play fiddle. Carla Sweeney McCartan, Colm O'Donnell, oh, there's a whole lot of people. Dave Flynn, the composer, Nuala Kennedy, Innie Kay, Emer Coughlin, and Francis Cunningham. You know, there's a whole lot, and I'm leaving out people here. It's just, you know, you'd have to, well, the radio show isn't long enough for that, I don't think.
I'm interested, West Cork has long been associated with classical music through the Chamber Music Festival. Did it seem like some form of unusual departure to bring a trad festival to Bantry when you did 22 years ago?
Well, it actually grew out of the Chamber Festival, in fact, because the late Dennis Cahill, who I played with for many years, both he and I went down there, I think, maybe in 1999 or sometime like that. And we played at the Chamber Festival, and it was their first time, I think, putting traditional Irish music in the West Cork Chamber Festival. And you know what? We felt like we connected with that audience, and that audience felt like they connected with us. And out of that grew the idea. And, Francis, who was the director of, Francis Humphreys, the director of West Cork Music, was kind of thinking, oh, well, let's try a traditional music thing. So they approached me on that. And I thought, after a good bit of thought, I decided to do it. Initially, I was trying to avoid the doing this, and I was trying to avoid, you know, I was trying to avoid his phone calls, I think. But but then I relented, and I'm very, very happy I did. That's what I can say. You know?
If you're standing where you are now with this year's festival and looking back across those 22 years, what sort of changes have you seen in trad music in that time?
Well, most of the people at the festival are now younger than me. That's one thing I've noticed. I've also noticed that among the younger generation of musicians, like, there was always this concern that maybe they wouldn't take it too seriously, or that they wouldn't play the music with the kind of depth and soul that we associate with old masters. But I think that's not actually the case. And I'm finding lots and lots of interesting younger generation musicians who are incredibly thoughtful and expressive and genuine and able to challenge the tradition, but also able to dig deep into it when they want to, you know. So I'm quite hopeful about it, and I feel good about where the music is headed with this generation of musicians.
I'd love to take another piece of music from Peggy's Dream by the Common Ground Ensemble. Will you introduce Colwyll an Solas for us?
Well, yes, this is a tune written by Padraig O'Riordan, actually, from Cooley, a son of the great Sean O'Riordan. I was down there recently at his Failing the Lake Festival, which was amazing. Anyway, Padraig is a great composer of tunes. And so almost in every project I do, I inevitably end up playing some of his tunes. And so this one is called Will and Solace, Where's the Light? And I have this imagined sense of this tune as being kind of light and imaginative and bright, but delicate as well, you know. So that's kind of how we approached it in the band, I think.
Okay, we'll take a little bit of that. Thank you. conscious, sadly, that might be all we have time for from that. It's from the Peggy's Dream album by the Common Ground Ensemble. Before we let you go, Martin, we should mention another festival, Common Threads, that you're appearing at, but thankfully you're not organising in the Burren in October. You're playing in your native Clare. That must be special for you.
Yeah, always. I like getting back to Clare. I was down at the Fetal Festival there very recently, and which is like my own locality. But yes, and I have a great affinity with the Burren and love it, and looking forward to playing up in Ballyvaughan for sure.
Martin, thanks a million for talking to us tonight on Arena. Masters of Tradition runs from the 20th to the 24th of August in Bantry, and there are further details from westcorkmusic.ie. Martin Hayes will also be headlining Common Threads Festival in the Burren from the 10th to the 12th of October, and you can book that at commonthreads.events. And that is it for Wednesday night's Arena. Shana Gorman produced. Research was by Paula Shields. Our broadcast coordinator tonight was Ollie Hamilton, and it was Cara O'Hare on sound. I'm Rick O'Shea. I'll talk to you tomorrow night from 6:30 here on Radio 1, and it's John Creedon next.